Session number 20456, Reel 30.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 14.
While you were in England, the atomic bomb was dropped on Japan. Can you remember what your reaction to that was?
I think almost disbelief. One had no idea that such a weapon existed or what might happen afterwards. I was actually under orders to move out back to the Far East when that happened. And, you know, one wondered what will happen now.
Did the news of the atomic bomb attack have a big impact on the people around you when it occurred?
That was difficult to say, because I had just got married. I was staying not very far from here in a very small cottage in Sussex. And so, until I actually reported for duty to Lynham to fly off, one really didn't know. I mean, what one read in the papers was neither here nor there.
When you did fly out to Ceylon, what did you think you were going to be doing when you got there? Did you have any idea of your future
Indeed,
duties?
Indeed, I was under orders to report to my old division, 2nd Division, which were reforming in India, for the various invasions that were being planned of Malaya, etc., etc., etc. It wasn't till I got to Kandy that I realised that was all off, clearly, and by which time Kandy and the staff were very occupied with taking the surrender of the Japanese army. And I met a lot of old chums there. It was very interesting. Leon Batten had his headquarters, the CIA headquarters, in the most palatial bungalow, with beautiful wrens and well-dressed sailors, and bells which, you know, clonked at time in naval hours. And a lot of very highly and well-dressed staff officers, who actually, many of them, had not seen a shot in Burma. They'd come out from all sorts of places. And there was a certain amount of interesting ill feeling between those of us who'd been through Burma and, you know, were sitting in Kandy, either doing a job of staff or, you know, wandering around waiting to be given a job. It was quite amusing. And it was called that great place, a lovely nickname for them, HMS Wimbledon, which was all rackets and balls.
How was this feeling expressed? Was it purely verbal or...?
Well, typical... I tried to find it, which is that lovely quotation, one of Shakespeare's plays, one of the Henrys, where a soldier is talking about a lord who passes him by. You know, and says, you know, sort of, well, he'd love to have been a soldier, but really, it was that sort of, the typical expression between the fighting soldier and the staff. It was fun, wasn't it?
Then I think you got sent to AFWEST PAC, presumably this would be Allied Forces Western Pacific.
Yes. I'm not too sure what the hell we were supposed to do when we got there. We went to Australia. It took 5 days to get up from Australia to Manila, where I walked into the arms of a splendid Australian brigadier.
Just Brigadier Wrigley?
Brigadier Hugh Wrigley, yes. Who said, right, just the chap I want. And I had... The one thing I have, it's in the corner there, I had it there, was my portable typewriter, which you can see there. You can see a Remington number 1 Portugal on the floor, you know, the other side of the table.
Yeah.
It still survives.
Still working?
Yes. Yes. But he used to brief me. He said, look, we've got this problem. He said, it's easy. He said, the Americans want to go back to America, the Canadians want to go to Canada. But he said, the Brits, where the hell do they want to go to? Some have wives and children in Hong Kong. Some have wives and children that went back to India. Some have possessions in Australia. And we've got to sort this one out. And we had sheaves of government telegrams with directives as to what choices people had.
Were you able to put that policy into effect, or
yes,
were you were?
I have to say that the Americans could not have been kinder, more helpful, but the big thing was, of course, a shortage of shipping. And we had two aircraft carriers came in. I think one went back to Singapore, the other went to Vancouver. And ships appeared from nowhere, and as soon as you got hold of a ship, you more or less said, where are you going to? All staff did. And they said, right, can you take X number of pretty sick POWs?
What sort of illnesses were they suffering from?
Oh, everything. Beriberi, every form of malnutrition, diarrheas, fevers. Some were in a dreadfully bad state and were in American hospitals being looked after by the Americans and couldn't travel.
I think originally you'd been intended to join this staff, which presumably would have been an American staff. How did they take to you being hijacked by Wrigley?
Well, they were delighted because they didn't want to deal with this problem. You know, thank God someone's arrived who, you know, can deal with it.
So they didn't mind you not turning up to do the job, which presumably was...
Well, the job had vanished with the atomic bomb, really.
Ah.
You see, the idea that one was going to have a big invasion with a sort of British corps and the British fleet, that was finished.
So you were effectively a floating
staff
officer.
Well, I wasn't floating then. I was under Australian command, as it were.
What did you make of the Philippines and the Filipinos? How did you...
Well, we didn't see very much of them. We were at a camp about 20 miles south of Manila. 21st Replacement Depot. It was about an hour's drive into Manila. And we passed this beautiful little bamboo church at Los Pinos, which has this worldwide... famous bamboo organ. But I mean, Manila was the most appalling mess I've ever seen. Awful.
Was that a result of war damage?
That was war damage. And deliberate blowings up by the Japanese.
Were there any Japanese still there when you arrived?
There are a few Japanese kept around to do fatigue parties and things in camps, yes, there were.
Did you have them in your camp as...?
I didn't deal with them, yes,
you didn't.
We did. They were very, very amenable, you know, worked very well.
Did as they were told?
Yeah.
You mentioned also the Dutch, that...
Problems, yes.
Problems with the Dutch because of the... disagreement between the Americans and the Dutch government about what was to happen in the Dutch East Indies.
Well, it didn't quite just apply to the Americans. It applied to the British as well, because the Americans did not want us back in Hong Kong, which they promised to Chiang Kai-shek, I am told. And a British squadron from the British fleet disobeyed its orders and bloody well sailed in and got the colony back. But the Netherlands East Indies, Indonesia, in those days, was in a dreadful state. So much so, and this is not generally known, that in certain cases, Japanese units, army units, fought with the British Army to help release prisoners. Who otherwise might have been murdered by the Indonesian guerrillas, and fought very well.
Of course, the other controversial area was the area of French Indochina. Did you come across any French refugees?
I didn't come across much because there weren't many. We didn't have any French prisoners in our area. Dutch, yes. The French were mostly kept in Indochina by the Japanese. I never saw it. Can't remember seeing any.
What happened to those Dutch people then? Did they manage
well,
to get back?
Eventually they were sent back to Indonesia, but they were delayed. And it was interesting reading the telegrams between Her Majesty's government and various people. as to what the hell was going on, what the views were. I'm not quite certain that we were all that keen to have the Dutch back. It was a very, very mixed up situation.
Did the Australians have a distinctive view of their own that you could
discern? No, enough, all the Australians were concerned was getting rid of these guys and getting back to Australia, as it were. I don't remember any... the Australian government policy, of course, impinged on the number of Brits coming in to Australia to retrieve their wives and families who have been evacuated there from Hong Kong and India.
What was the policy on that? It was to get them in and out as quickly as possible.
They were very good. Funny enough, I just got a Christmas card from one of my chums, who was an old guy who was one of those evacuated. He was evacuated from Sumatra. But the whole problem was one of linking up families, administrative units, their regiments, and their possessions. Particularly, so much of the army in Hong Kong and Malaysia was Indian army that fell into Japanese hands, and their wives had been sent all over the world, some to South Africa.
Sounds as though it was really an administrative nightmare, a matter of endless paperwork.
One of the things I did using that machine was every guy. We had a card index for Richmond, Lumberjack name, of course. And then where he was captured, where his wife and family were evacuated to, or if not, which regimental depot in India should he go back to?
What about civilians? Did you have civilian internees as well?
Not many.
POW?
No, I didn't. I mean, there were a few. One of my officers with me was a guy, the RAF officer who wrote that wonderful book, The Wooden Horse.
Eric Williams.
I've got a picture of him. He was a very, very, very high-grade guy.
What was his role? Was he on the same
staff? Here I think they made a slight psychological error. They sent out a lot of people who had been prisoners of war in Germany to deal with these people. Well, there was an interesting psychological difference between the German prisoners of war and the British prisoners of war. The Japanese prisoners of war, the German prisoners of war had in many ways a longer but much easier time. And the two didn't really quite understand each other.
That was just the imprint of experience, was it?
I suppose your war office and people, I mean, it's just all, well, what are we going to do with these people? They've just come back, we can't retrain them to fight and fly again. You know, here's a job they can do.
In any case, the war was coming to an end.
Yes, and of course, you've got to remember that I was at just a tiny, small part of it. It was all over Southeast Asia, what they call Rapwe, very much in Malaysia and Indochina.
Now, I think your next posting was back to the regiment.
Yes.
As second in command. And that you travel out to Palestine in March 1946.
Correct.
You mentioned that on the ship out to Port Said from Toulon, you met a number of members of the Jewish Brigade.
Yes.
And that you had some discussions with them.
Yes.
And that they were rather critical of British policy.
Rather, it's understanding. Very, I would say.
What sort of line of argument were they
Well, they were
taking?
A very nice lot. And these were... It wasn't, I think, until 1941-42 that the Jewish agency, the people who ran the Jewish organization in Palestine, really allowed the Jews to join up in numbers to form a Jewish brigade. And two reasons, I think. The first reason was they wanted that sort of person in Palestine, you know, welfare. And secondly, they didn't want them to get too integrated with British ideas, I think.
You mean they didn't want them joining individual British regiments?
They didn't join. They were actually, the Jews that fought in Palestine fought under the, I think they were ex-battalions of the Queen's Regiment, I can't remember. But they had their own badge. They were a pretty high-grade lot. And you see, they were being egged on by the Americans. You had all the pressures of the concentration camps. What do you do with these people? And I forget what the figure was that Truman wanted. I think they wanted us to accept 100,000 of them.
I think that was a symbolic figure for...
Yes, but still, I mean, it was a figure that didn't make any sense at all.
What did these chaps say to you then, the ones you met on the ship? What line were they taking about Palestine and its future?
What they were saying was that they were being artificially confined by the British to small areas, or not necessarily the British, whoever held the mandate. And there they had been trying to help their brothers in distress on the continent. And now they, you know, they'd fought the war and all this, and now they're getting precious little thanks for it. And, you know, were being made to look a bit idiotic in the face of their compatriots.
What did you think about Palestine? Had you had any ideas about Palestine and the question of the mandate and its future before you met these chaps?
None. Our first battalion had been in Palestine just before the war. I wasn't with them. I was in India. I'm afraid my education about Palestine was practically nil.
So you had no preconceived ideas?
Absolutely
or
none.
Expectations?
No. Except, of course, that having come from Europe, one did have... and again, the Far East prisoner business, one did have a lot of sympathy with the wretched victims of the concentration camps. You know, and one felt that somehow one ought to do something about it, but what the hell?
Did you have any briefing about what was going on before you left England?
No.
You say that you met Sandy Bardwell in Egypt.
Yes, yes.
By almost by accident.
Well, I mean, you know, I met him about 4 o'clock in the evening. We had dinner, and he was away the next morning, and I was away the next afternoon. So that one really had no political briefing. We had a lot of briefing about personalities and the battalion and so on. Yeah, sure.
Did he give you any idea of what the battalion had been doing and was expecting to be doing?
Yes.
In a military sense.
Yes. Mostly, they were mostly cordoning and searching villages and towns, Tel Aviv, for example.
Were they being successful according to that briefing?
Well, one didn't know because our cordons and searches, you sort of got the guys out of their houses, put them in a sort of barbed wire cage as well today, and Palestine police would come and interrogate them. What the interrogations were about, heaven knows. We wouldn't know. It was not passed down to us.
So the police work of gathering information was kept separate in a different compartment?
Yes. It was very interesting. It wasn't until we got to Jerusalem that I got a policeman, senior policeman, to talk to our officers about the organization of the Jewish Haganah, IZL, Stone Gang, underground forces, who they were, you know, where they came from, what to look out for. We had nothing before that.
What sort of state was the battalion in when you rejoined them?
Oh, Camp 21, typical army, Middle East desert camp, huts, perfectly comfortable for what one had. There was a certain amount of, by the seaside, you would bathe, you would ride, a lot of football was played, a lot of athletics, that sort of thing, hockey. I wouldn't like to be stationed there permanently.
Was the camp secure? Did it have a defensible perimeter and arrangements for?
Oh, yes.
What sort of arrangements had, did you
have? Well, one had some barbed wire perimeter fence and sentries and patrols at night, right? Yeah.
Were there ever any incidents while you were there?
Yes, there were.
What sort of things?
I can't remember whether we had any. The Ochsenbucks and the Ulster Rifles certainly did, I know that. With what they were after was arms and ammunition.
Did they get them?
A few. Not very many.
Now, you said in your memoirs that Colonel Lumley Webb, whom you call the Squire,
yes,
that he had no time for Jews or Arabs.
No.
what was... Did he express his views to you when you arrived as his deputy? What did he say to you?
Well, I mean, we were very friends. I'd known him since I was a small boy. Squire was typical of a late Victorian gentleman. And, you know, who rather thought that all wogs started at Calais, if you know what I mean. That included Frenchmen.
Well, it would, for a man of that generation.
He had precious little time for them as a whole. On the other hand, there were the odd Palestine policemen, like this chap I described, Syed Bey Idrisi, who was a beautiful shot and rode as well, who was very much a gentleman in his own rights, in his own country, who Squire would have a lot of time for. You know, they would have a meeting of minds there.
But Syed Idrisi was a Circassian, wasn't he?
He was Circassian.
Presumably with ancestry going back to the Caucasus.
That's it.
And therefore not an Arab.
Well,
or a Jew. Yeah,
exactly. You have put your finger on it. Yes.
What did the Colonel give you a briefing when you arrived about what he expected you to do for him as his 2IC?
Not really, no. It was a funny old business.
What was your main job then as 2IC of the regiment? How did you...
The main job was to sort that bloody battalion out.
What was wrong with it?
Well, it had come... It was a composite lot. First of all, our 1st Battalion, 91st, had not of reasons of its own, had a very good war. It started off in the desert, then it was smashed in Crete, then it went down to the Sudan, it didn't do very much. Then it became part of a beach break for the landing in Sicily. Eventually, in the last 18 months of the war, it became... part of the 8th Indian Division. And compared with the other battalions of the regiment, it hadn't quite done the sort of fighting, you know, it wasn't. And so, therefore, in some ways, it had a slight inferiority complex. It was then reinforced to go to Palestine by large drafts of people who had still 2 years or so to serve. From the 7th and 8th battalions, particularly, who had very good war, and these were very, very battle experienced soldiers. And so you had three sort of, I mean, the 8th was a very, very Highland battalion, probably the best battalion of the regiment in 2 wars. We had some absolutely super NCOs. We had a mixture of officers, most of them pretty good, but these guys didn't want to waste their time mucking about in Palestine.
What did they want to do? They wanted to get
back to work in universities and things, you see. I mean, the war was won.
What proportion of these chaps were regulars then?
Oh, very few. I can tell you almost the thing. Esquire, myself, Peter Cuthill was short service regular. I think if we had 8 regular officers in the battalion, we were lucky at that stage.
And they came from different battalions, therefore different backgrounds or experience?
Well, no, most of them had come from either the 1st or 2nd battalions, yes.
Did you find that the soldiers had difficulty getting on with each other because they came from different battalions?
No, the soldiers had no difficulties at all. The soldiers were just bloody good. The difficulty was explaining to the sailors what the hell they were doing there.
In what sense? Explaining in
that? Well, the war was over, you know. They had joined to fight Hitler, or the Japanese. They hadn't joined to prolong the British Empire. I mean, the British Empire meant nothing to them. I'm quite certain of that. On the other hand, a certain regimental pride did. They weren't going to be bucked about by Jews or Arabs. That was a very different thing. But I mean, there was no great crusading. The reason for them joining the army had disappeared.
Did any of them ever show signs of developing an idea that they ought not to be in Palestine, that they had a positive duty to to leave Palestine?
No. I don't know if you've read on where I talk about the mutineers from, I think it was the 10th Para Regiment who joined us, who were absolutely superb chaps. And of course, there were several mutinies of sorts. There was the big one, which was the Signals and the RAF in
Alcantara,
And again, what was the trouble there was a total lack of decent officers to look after them. And they were totally bored.
Nothing to do?
Nothing to do, except, you know, issue stores or sit on the airfare zone and listen to Signals. And they knew damn well that if they put the pressure on, they could, I don't say bring the whole House of Cards down, but they could make life very difficult.
Now, you mentioned these chaps who came to you from Malaya with this reputation of being Bolshe.
Yes.
And you said that you discovered what had gone wrong. What had actually gone wrong in Malaya for them?
They were putting in a camp, I think it was Kluang, and they were given no job, nothing to do. The officers went whizzing down the town and so on, and I think I'm going to ask the parachute regiment how much they'll tell you about it, I don't know. But the whole battalion was disbanded, broken up.
Was this just a matter, again, of the devil making work for idle hands to do, them not having occupation?
I think it was thoroughly bad command structure, thoroughly bad officers. Did you see that thing on the television the other night about the mutiny at Algiers?
Yes, indeed.
Well, same thing.
Oh, I see. I wondered if it had been something like that.
Well, I think it was there as damage, yes. I mean, once we got them, they were superb guys. We never had a cheap iron. They were so pleased to be with a decent unit.
Did they settle in quickly with the other guys in the battalion?
Just like that. No problem. But you know, when you get a telegram saying 50 mutinous soldiers from 10th Barrow are joining you tomorrow, you think, crikey.
You warn the guardroom.
Well, I don't know. Well, who are these chaps?
How did you actually post them? Did you post them out to...
Well, we found out there. The first thing we did, we got hold of them off the train to Jerusalem. We got them up the barracks. We gave them breakfast or whatever it was. And I personally saw them. And I said, welcome, you know, this is it. I said, the first thing we've got to do is to find out what sort of specialists you are. And this will take a little bit of time, and as soon as we've done that, we'll post you to your various companies, platoons, and things.
What sort of specialists were they? Were they a mixed
bag?
Well,
you had signalers, you had machine gunners, you had mortarmen, you had drivers, you had cooks. We had a total cross section of the boys.
So they were just put into slots, as and
when? We had lots of open slots that we could receive them.
Well, were these paratroopers regulars or short?
No, they were mostly National Service.
National Service.
There were one or two regulars, one of whom stayed on, became a company sergeant major in the regiment. A very good chap.
Do you know where he was from? Was he from the Highlands? Or
no, he wasn't. He was from Yorkshire.
Now, you said you had to get a grip of it and shake it up. How did you go about doing that, getting the battalion into good order?
The first thing one discovered was that they had never...